The following is a Relevant Radio program and is protected under U.S. copyright laws. This program is made possible through the contributions of listeners like you. Support Relevant Radio by clicking on the donate icon at www.relevantradio.com.
Never knew such a love could be found. It's so amazing. I can taste, I can feel, I can see, for I am facing love divine. You are mine. You have found me just in time. You are mine. All in all, love divine.
Bridging the gap for your morning drive, it's Morning Air with Sean Harriott.
He was kind of funny looking.
In what way?
I don't know, just funny looking.
Along with Glenn Leverins, bringing you the news from the Vatican and around the world. And now, here's your host, Sean Harriott.
Hey, good morning. Welcome to a Tuesday edition of Morning Air. Glad to be along with you. And lots to talk about. Of course, Glenn's Story Corner coming up in just a few minutes. George Weigel will join me also a little bit later this hour to talk a little bit about the Pope and the President, the meeting between Pope Benedict XVI and President Obama, what happened at the meeting, and where we go from here. So certainly looking forward to that as well. Joining me right now is Patrick Crouch. He's project manager for the Earthworks Urban Farm, a program of the Capuchin Soup Kitchen, a human service organization of caring people inspired by the spirit of St. Francis and sponsored by the Capuchins of the province of St. Joseph and concerned benefactors. Earthworks seeks to promote sustainable agriculture practices, nutrition, and care for the earth. It was recently named one of the top 10 urban farms in the country by National Environmental Magazine, Natural Home. You can find out more about it at the website cskdetroit.org. That's cskdetroit.org. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning.
Glad to have you on the show today.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Well, I lived and worked in the Detroit area for about 10 years, and I remember when the last chain grocery store pulled out of the city of Detroit.
Yeah, there was that would be... Well, actually, the Farmer Jack was probably the last chain grocery store, and I think it pulled out about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Final one.
And that that means there's a whole city full of people who essentially buy all their groceries at convenience stores, and they don't have access... They don't have access to fresh food for the most part.
Certainly, you know, that's one of the where the main sort of catalyst for this was from, was sort of looking at how big an issue access was in the city and the fact that a lot of folks were looking at buying their groceries from places like gas stations and convenience stores, or what are referred to as party stores, mostly focused on things like lottery tickets and cigarettes and liquor, and have small amounts of food. So there's not a great selection, and what food is there is usually not fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And so certainly the urban farm itself is one aspect of how we can help provide folks, but we've been working on all kinds of ways of improving food security throughout the city.
And certainly the Capuchins have been there for a long time, making sure that that everybody gets fed who wants to be fed.
For over 80 years now, we serve about 2,000 meals a day between the two locations. So we've been in the business of trying to improve folks' access to food, and part of this is looking at what are other ways that we can not just address those that have, you know, sort of emergency food needs, but also long-term as well. So
mm-hmm.
that's, you know, folks are healthier so that they're able to work, so they're able to take care of their families.
So when did you actually start the Earthworks Urban Farm?
The farm was started in 97 by a Capuchin friar by the name of Brother Rick Salmon. And it's since then grown. Originally, it was just one small parcel of land, and we're now on about an acre and a half of land,
mm-hmm.
Spread across several sites.
Wow. So how much food do you end up harvesting in a given year?
You know, it definitely varies. You know, this year seems we've had a really cool summer, so we'll probably have lower yields, but we probably do around between 6,000 and 8,000 pounds of produce, most of which goes in the soup kitchen itself.
Mm. And do you also have families that come in to get some of this produce?
What we've done is, so we've actually started setting up a mobile market that drives throughout the the city, well, mostly in our neighborhood. They drive around and set up at different locations, community centers, and that sort of thing. And this has been a community sort of oriented project. It was something spurred by folks coming to the kitchen itself, of something they felt they could do. And we've asked them to set up a market stand that we would be able to accept the food stamp benefits here, so that folks that wanted to buy our produce could do that through that. But we also, anybody who comes and volunteers with us is going to go home with some food. Mm-hmm. Anybody who asks for something is going to go home with something. A lot of what we do is try and distribute transplants and seeds so folks can grow their own gardens and do lots of classes on growing your own food. We feel like that's one of the most powerful ways that we can improve folks' access, is by them growing it themselves.
And for a lot of folks, I mean, a backyard garden can really help to fill in the gaps there that in terms of the produce they're not getting.
Sure. I mean, it's convenient and it's easy access. And Detroit, you know, one thing it does have is it's got plenty of land.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not lacking that in the same way that other urban areas are. But I think there's also the other components that are really important that a lot of times folks don't look at, of that it's a great opportunity for adults and children to spend time together. It's a great opportunity for applied science lessons to be experienced, so kids can actually learn more, you know, in the space instead of just out of a textbook and that sort of thing. It's a really great intergenerational learning tool of having grandparents and parents and children all together in a space community.
How many people does it take to work an acre and a half of land?
Well, it probably doesn't take that many, yeah. Actually. But we're largely volunteer-driven, so, we have volunteers. I mean, we have literally hundreds of volunteers throughout the season that come through.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of groups from churches and youth organizations coming through every weekend and helping us out. And certainly that's one of the things, is that, you know, it is not the most productive space because it's volunteer-oriented, but we're not just focused on production. And certainly the farm itself, you know, the actual farming is just one small aspect of what we do. You know, we have youth programming that we do. We have a couple after-school programs. We do a huge amount of transplants that we distribute to the public so that they can grow their own food. We have classes and community gatherings for discussions, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And do you plan at any point to expand the operation at all?
You know, we've sort of looked at it, and, you know, one of the things we're most interested in is how can we improve folks' economic opportunities surrounding sort of filling the need in our community for more fresh produce, but at the same time also addressing the need for economic viability in the community. And so we've really been trying to help support economic development around food systems.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things we're most interested in sort of is the idea of us acting as basically a business incubator for folks that are interested in starting a small business, whether it be distribution or processing or actual growing. So in terms of where we see our expansion going, it probably wouldn't be physically enlarge our space that we would be cultivating, but to possibly acquire more area for others to cultivate.
Mm. And you mentioned that most of the produce goes to the soup kitchen. How many people is the soup kitchen feeding now? And have you seen an uptick with the economic issues that Detroit has now?
So the numbers that we usually say is it's around 2,000 meals a day that you know, and some of those are definitely repeat customers, so that's not necessarily a single individuals. In terms of the economic changes, you know, we haven't necessarily seen an increase in our services, and I think that's largely because of the community that we're working with has not really necessarily been particularly affected directly.
Oh, sure.
By the downturn, because they're not necessarily, most of the folks are individuals that have been out of work for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, talking with some of our community partners who work in, we're right down the street from our partner organization, Gleaners Food Bank, who serves all of Southeast Michigan, and they have said that their numbers have pretty much been flat in Detroit, but that they've seen large amounts of increases in need in the surrounding metro area and the suburban areas. And so that's really where the change has been made. So.
Mm. I've been talking with Patrick Crouch. He's project manager for the Earthworks Urban Farm, a program of Detroit's Capuchin Soup Kitchen. You can find out more online at cskdetroit.org. That's cskdetroit.org. Patrick, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It is 15 minutes past the hour. More to come here on Morning Air.
Catholic radio is a marvelous tool, not only for learning the faith over again, but for all of us still trying to learn it the first time around.
Relevant radio.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Women need to be told about the risks of abortion. This was the shocking statement made by Barbara Kay, a pro-abortion columnist for the National Post. She says there are ample studies out there showing even early abortion causes future premature birth. This can cause all kinds of problems for babies like autism or cerebral palsy. She says this information is readily available to abortionists and should be shared with women before they have an abortion. Ms. Kay says that if she were the mother of a premature baby with these serious problems, she'd be angry enough to sue the abortionist for keeping her in the dark. What it boils down to, Barbara Kay writes, does abortion on demand provide empowerment or bamboozlement of women? A pro-lifer couldn't have said it better.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.
Would you consider abortion in the following situations? There's a preacher and a wife who are very poor. They have 14 kids. She now finds out she's pregnant, and they're living in some pretty harsh poverty. Scenario two, they have four children. First child is blind, the second is deaf, the third is deaf, the fourth has TB. She finds she's pregnant again. Third, a white man rapes a 13-year-old black girl, and she gets pregnant. Four, a teenage girl is pregnant. She's not married. Her fiancé is not the father of the baby. If you said yes to scenario one, you would have just killed John Wesley, one of the greatest evangelists of the 19th century. Two, if you would have had an abortion there, you would have just killed Beethoven. And in the third case, you would have just killed Ethel Walters, the great gospel singer. Four, if you would have said yes to this case, you would have just declared the murder of Jesus Christ.
Glad to be along with you this hour. And joining me right now is George Weigel. He's Distinguished Senior Fellow of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He's a Catholic theologian and one of America's leading public intellectuals. Mr. Weigel, good morning.
Good morning.
We talked with you last week a little bit about the upcoming meeting between Barack Obama and Pope Benedict. And now that that meeting's actually taken place, I'd love to get some of your thoughts on it.
Well, you may have seen Sean, the headline in the Vatican newspaper, the Osservatore Romano, which said that it had been a cordial meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was entirely to be expected. The Pope is a gentleman. He's not given to shouting. The president was obviously intent on making a good impression. Perhaps the most telling thing symbolically was the Pope's gift of the recent Vatican instruction on bioethics, Dignitas Personae, to President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
That suggests to me that the Holy Father is entirely aware of where the fault line lies between the Catholic Church and this administration. He also gave him a copy of his new encyclical, which stresses at least 5 points that I've been able to identify, that the life issues are social justice issues, and that you can't divide the questions of abortion, euthanasia, embryo-destructive stem cell research from questions of fundamental justice in the economy, et cetera.
Yeah.
So you can't have social justice Catholics on one side and, you know, life issues Catholics on another.
Right.
All of this emerges out of the same set of Catholic convictions about the dignity of the human person.
Mm-hmm.
so I, you know, I hope those messages were delivered. I frankly don't expect to see too much change in the administration's policies, although we can always hope and pray that there will be. I do think that if the message of the encyclical gets through, we might see some movement among Catholic legislators on these questions. At least it should be harder for them to do this kind of bob and weave business about, you know, well, I'm with you guys on the social justice stuff, but.
Right.
So we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, that does seem to be an important part of this mix, especially as you saw the Obama campaign reaching out to Catholics in a pretty aggressive way, and they really kind of continue to do that now.
Well, I think this is the point that has to be stressed. At Notre Dame in May, and in his July 2nd interview with Religion Reporters, the president has subtly but unmistakably injected himself and his office into the debate over the nature of Catholic identity in America.
Mm-hmm.
This is no place for the President of the United States to be, whether the Christian community in question is Catholic or Protestant. It is simply not the business of the President to insert himself into defining who's a good Catholic, who's a good Lutheran, who's a good Methodist, whatever. That is a fundamental challenge. It's driven by wedge politics of the sort you describe. And it needs to be quite bluntly, I think, rebuffed by the bishops, who have to make clear that they own the Catholic brand in America.
Mm.
And they will decide, you know, what that brand means.
Yeah, and we've seen, you know, increasing criticism of bishops for talking to their own people about these sorts of issues.
Well, I'm sorry that people are just going to have to get used to this, because it is a very sad commentary on 40 years of inadequate catechesis that most Catholics in the United States thought that the Notre Dame thing was about politics. It was not about politics. It was about ecclesiology. It was about the nature of the church. And that people don't understand that and have to be reminded of it is what we have bishops for. Paul tells Timothy, you know, preach the gospel in and out of season. Well, we're in a tough season right now, which is a lifetime Baltimore Orioles fan I'm used to. If people don't like that, tough.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we can see a turnaround in this sort of ignorance on the part of Catholics of what their own church teaches?
I think the basic problem, Sean, is not simply ignorance of what the church teaches, but of what the church is.
Yeah.
You know, and that the church is not simply another voluntary organization in the gamut of American suburban voluntary organizations or urban voluntary organizations. Once you're clear on what the church is, then you can get clear on why the church teaches what it does.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic challenge now, I think, is to make clearer what it means to be a member of the Catholic Church. We need to get on with the re-catechesis of the church in America on that very basic point.
Do you think that some of the ways the bishops have engaged some of these high-profile, you know, pro-abortion politicians, you think that'll help at all?
Well, it gets people's attention. But I also think that the bishops are facing a very difficult task of trying to maintain the discipline of the church in a church where many people don't understand what the church is.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I come back to the point, we need more effective preaching and adult Christian formation on what is distinctive about belonging to the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean just distinctive in terms of specific doctrinal points. I mean, in a fundamental understanding of, you know, what it means to be incorporated into the body of Christ, which is ordered in a particular way by the will of Christ, namely under the leadership of bishops, and in which different people have different responsibilities. Mm-hmm. All of this is Vatican II 101, and it seems very odd that 45 plus years after the opening of the council, we're still fumbling around with this.
And it does. I've been talking with George Weigel, and you can check out his article, The President and the Pope, at the Ethics and Public Policy Center's website, eppc.org. That's eppc.org. Mr. Weigel, thank you.
Thanks, Sean. Great to be with you.
25 minutes past the hour. Coming up, I'll bring you a conversation I had a while back with Father Tad Poholchik, talking about what to do with leftover embryos from in vitro fertilization procedures. There's kind of a move afoot to start using them more in experimentation, but you've got to get the parents to sign off on that. So that opens a whole, sort of a whole new other can of worms. So I'll bring you that conversation with Father Poholchik coming up in just a few minutes. Hey, I just want to take a moment and remind you that Relevant Radio is listener-supported. And that means that the engine that drives Relevant Radio is really your donation. That is the thing that makes it possible for us to be able to bring you compelling programming, to bring you national figures like George Weigel, to be able to talk to you about things like the Capuchin Soup Kitchen's effort to grow food locally there in the Detroit area, and so many other important things that we talk about in the course of a week. So I'd like to ask you to consider a gift to Relevant Radio, 877-291-0123. That's the number you can call this morning. It's toll-free, and it's very easy to donate. You can also donate online. That's fast and easy as well at relevantradio.com. Whichever way you go, you've got the opportunity here to help Relevant Radio to be able to continue in your community, to be able to continue for years to come in other communities across the country and around the world, literally, as people listen over the internet. So please do consider a gift, 877-291-0123. You can also donate online. That's fast and easy at relevantradio.com. Whatever you do, thanks so much for your prayerful support of Relevant Radio. And please tell a friend about the programming you're hearing right here as well. Hey, lots more to come. Father James Kubicki is next. He's got today's prayer and reflection. I'll bring you that conversation with Father Tad Poholchik about leftover IVF embryos, what to do with them, and the ethical implications of some of the decisions that have already been made. And of course, Glenn's Story Corner, all of that coming up this half hour on the program.
July is a great month of saints, and today we're celebrating the first Native American woman to be beatified, Blessed Kateri Tekakwitha. Hi, I'm Father James Kubicki. In my life and ministry as a Jesuit, I've spent 9 years among the Native American people of western South Dakota. Now, Kateri was from New York and from a different tribe. She was half Algonquin and half Mohawk. But Native American people around the United States claim her as one of their own. As can we all, because holiness crosses all boundaries and cultures. Kateri was orphaned when she was 4 and was baptized in 1676 when she was 20. About 3 years later, on the Feast of the Annunciation, she made a vow of perpetual virginity. Only a year later, she died with these words on her lips, Jesus konoronk wa. Jesus, I love you. Pope John Paul beatified her in 1980, and when he visited with Native people on a trip to the U.S., he told them, your encounter with the gospel has not only enriched you, it has enriched the church. We are well aware that this has not taken place without its difficulties and, occasionally, its blunders. However, the gospel does not destroy what is best in you. On the contrary, it enriches the spiritual qualities and gifts that are distinctive of your cultures. These words remind me of something St. Paul wrote in his first letter to Timothy, chapter 2, verse 4. God wills everyone to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. For there is one God. There is also one mediator between God and the human race, Christ Jesus, himself human, who gave himself as ransom for all.
It's 24 minutes in front of the hour, and I wanted to bring you a conversation I had a while back with Father Tad Poholchek, Director of Education, neuroscientist, and staff ethicist for the National Catholic Bioethics Center, and here's that conversation.
Good morning, Sean. How are you?
Oh, doing well. So glad you could join us today.
Delighted to be with you.
I remember we talked about this a couple of years ago as the idea of embryo adoption was getting popular, and this is what was before the church put out a paper on this. I saw a Religion News Service article in which you were quoted. I thought there were some really interesting things brought up. One was that there was a researcher talking about this who said that she felt since religious people were the ones objecting to this, embryos being used for experimentation, they should come up with some other solution and they should fund it.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting idea. I mean, it puts the onus on religious people when, in fact, it was not those religious people who created the problem in the first place.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a strange situation. I think that religious people obviously are deeply concerned and deeply troubled by the prospect of the continuing creation of more embryos and by the whole problem of how do we handle the ones that have already been created? So it's sort of a catch-22, I think, that we're struggling to make some sense out of. And it's a simple reminder to us how whenever you make sinful choices, whenever you choose to break the moral law, you back yourself into some very awkward kinds of corners.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not easy to get out of them.
Yeah, and we're definitely in one now. How many embryos are in this, in cold storage at this point?
More than 400,000. They counted back in 2003 how many of them there were in the United States, and it was slightly less than 400,000. So in the intervening, 6 years since then, there have been many more created, and so we're certainly above 400,000, and that's quite an impressive number when you stop and think about it. I mean, that's the size of a small city. A city I often mention to people is about the same size as the city of Tucson,
wow,
Arizona.
And one of the things that you mentioned in the article too was that there are some countries that limit the number of embryos that are created in the IVF procedure so that this doesn't happen.
Yes, we have laws that exist in Germany and in Italy that deal specifically with this problem. And these laws are, you might say, they're laws to prevent collateral damage. And what I mean by that is that the law says that whenever you do in vitro, you're not permitted to create extra or supernumerary embryos.
Mm.
You're only allowed to make a grand total of three, and all three of those embryos that you make have to be implanted into their mother. So this is a way of just making sure that things don't get out of hand here, that things don't snowball. And in Germany and in Italy, they have virtually no frozen embryos to speak of. So a situation that is very, very different from what we have in the United States. And, you know, that kind of a law, people often say, well, that's a Catholic law, you Catholics imposing your views on the rest of us. And I always say to people, no, it's not a Catholic law at all. A Catholic law would completely outlaw in vitro fertilization.
Yeah.
And so here, this is a kind of law that is just meant to limit the harm.
Mm. And how many embryos does a typical IVF procedure here in the States create?
Well, that depends a little bit on the practice of the individual clinic. But what you typically do is you try to get as many eggs out of the woman as you possibly can. So if things go well after you have superovulated her, you may get, 20, 30, even 40 eggs from a single woman. And in some cases, they will fertilize all the eggs that they obtain. And so then you end up with 20, 30, 40 human beings in the petri dish, only a few of whom end up being selected to go on to the next step of being implanted into their mother, and the remainder of which are either poured down the sink or frozen in liquid nitrogen for cryopreservation.
And we're seeing a movement of scientists who would like families to start donating these embryos for experimentation.
Yes, there is kind of a movement. I would say this movement has most of its pressure coming from the Protestant side of the equation. Catholics understand, I would say, in general, that there's, you know, there's some deeper questions and concerns that are raised by this whole approach of embryo adoption, as we call it. And so the Protestants have actually put together a group called the Snowflakes group, and they basically make the arrangements so that these embryos can be transferred from couples who have abandoned their own children in the deep freeze to other couples who might implant them, gestate them, and raise them as if they were their own children. And this has been done on a small scale. You know, there's probably no more than a couple of hundred babies in the United States that have been born this way so far.
And you've expressed concerns about this for quite a while, and the church came out with a position paper on this in 2008 and really underscored the concerns that you and others had about it.
Yes, that's right. I've always felt that this is not a moral approach to the situation. I mean, all of us feel terrible about these embryos who are trapped in the deep freeze, and we would love to be able to find some answer, but this doesn't look like it's the answer, because I'm convinced you end up violating the very meaning of marriage when you do this, that marriage is not about using your wife as an incubator for somebody else's children in this fashion. And the Vatican came out with a paper that it was called Dignitas Personae, and it's actually a very important document, and this was rather recently that they issued this. And in that document, they dealt with the question of embryo adoption, and they basically used cautionary language. It was almost, you know, putting on the brakes, or a kind of yellow light, you might say, that they were flashing in front of us, that, you know, there are many ethical issues here that are raised by this that people need to be attentive to, and it was language that, in my opinion, seemed to be pointing towards a possible future statement by the church that would come down even more strongly in opposition to this. It was not a definitive statement, you know, in this recent document, but it certainly was tending in the direction of caution.
Yeah. So there really is no easy or good solution, and you suggest that families just remain responsible for those embryos.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when we have children, all of us understand that there are real responsibilities, and this includes financial responsibilities, in the sense that when you have kids, you have the duty to clothe them, to put a roof over their heads, to pay for their education, to take care of them in all these different ways. But when you have children who are frozen, you can't do any of those things. Mm-hmm. The best you can do to care for your children is to pay the monthly bill to the company that will be pouring fresh liquid nitrogen into their tanks to safeguard them, to protect them. So this is, I think, the minimal parental duty that we have towards our own offspring, towards our own children, who are in this unfortunate quandary of being unable to get out of cryopreservation.
Mm. I've been talking with Father Ted Polchek. He's Director of Education at the National Catholic Bioethics Center in Philadelphia, and lots of good information there, lots of papers on a whole range of issues at their website. You can check it out at ncbcenter.org. That's ncbcenter.org. Father Polchek, thanks so much.
Great to be with you, Sean. Thank you.
Glenn's Story Corner coming up next. Stay with us.
Between your station and EWTN, I've learned more about my faith than I have in any other time in my life. I couldn't do without this.
Relevant Radio.
This is the Saint of the Day for July 14th from the Franciscans and St. Anthony Messenger Press. Today we celebrate Blessed Kateri Tekakwitha. The first North American native to be beatified was baptized in 1676 and died 4 years later. Her life and grace grew rapidly. Kateri's mother was a Christian Algonquin and wife to the chief of the Mohawk clan. At age 4, Kateri lost her family in a smallpox epidemic that left her disfigured and half-blind. The uncle who adopted her did not welcome the young girl's growing interest in the Catholic faith or the influence of the Jesuit missionaries on her. At 19, Kateri refused to marry and converted to Catholicism. Her radical actions left her in danger. On the advice of a priest, she stole away one night and walked 200 miles to a Christian Indian village near Montreal. There she grew in holiness under the direction of a priest and an Iroquois woman, spending long hours in prayer, charity, and strenuous penance. At 23, Kateri took a vow of virginity. When she died, her emaciated face reportedly changed color and became like that of a healthy child. The touch of a smile was on her lips. There's more about the saints, along with inspiration and Catholic resources, at our website, franciscanradio.org. From the Franciscans and St. Anthony Messenger Press, this is Saint of the Day.
It's Catholic spiritual direction, and it's only on Relevant Radio.
What does it mean to be a man of God today? Join us for the next Inner Life when Father Rick Heilman, founder of the Knights of Divine Mercy, will be here to offer some tips and suggestions on being a real man of God. It's male spirituality, and it's only on the next Inner Life.
Don't miss the Inner Life, 12 noon Eastern, 11 a.m. Central, only on Relevant Radio.
It's 12 minutes in front of the hour. Sean Harriet on Morning Air. And time now for Glenn Leverins with Glenn's Story Corner.
Our story today is called Love You Forever by Robert Munch. A mother held her new baby and very slowly rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while she held him, she sang, I'll love you forever, I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be. The baby grew. He grew and grew and grew. He grew until he was 2 years old, and he ran all around the house. He pulled all the books off the shelves. He pulled all the food out of the refrigerator, and he took his mother's watch and flushed it down the toilet. Sometimes his mother would say, "This kid is driving me crazy." But at nighttime, when that two-year-old was quiet, she opened the door to his room, crawled across the floor, looked up over the side of his bed, and if he was really asleep, she picked him up and rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. While she rocked him, she sang, I'll love you forever, I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be. The little boy grew, and grew, and grew, and grew. He grew till he was 9 years old, and he never wanted to come in for dinner. He never wanted to take a bath, and when Grandma visited, he always said bad words. Sometimes his mother wanted to sell him to the zoo. But at nighttime, when he was asleep, the mother quietly opened the door to his room, crawled across the floor, and looked up over the side of the bed. If he was really asleep, she picked up that 9-year-old boy and rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while she rocked him, she sang, I'll love you forever, I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be. The boy grew. He grew and grew and grew. He grew until he was a teenager. He had strange friends and wore strange clothes and listened to strange music. Sometimes the mother felt like she was in a zoo. But at nighttime, when that teenager was asleep, the mother opened the door to his room, crawled across the floor, and looked up over the side of the bed. If he was really asleep, she picked up that great big boy and rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while she rocked him, she sang, I'll love you forever, I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be. That teenager grew, and he grew and grew and grew. He grew until he was a grown-up man. He left home and got a house across town. But sometimes on dark nights, the mother got into her car and drove across town. If all the lights in her son's house were out, she opened his bedroom window, crawled across the floor and looked up over the side of his bed. If that great big man was really asleep, she picked him up and rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while she rocked him, she sang, "I'll love you forever. I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be." Well, that mother, she got older. She got older and older and older. And one day she called up her son and said, "You'd better come see me because I'm very old and sick." So her son came to see her. And when he came in the door, she tried to sing the song. She sang, "I'll love you forever. I'll like you for always." But she couldn't finish because she was too old and sick. The son went to his mother, and he picked her up and rocked her back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And he sang this song, "I'll love you forever, I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my mommy you'll be." When the son came home that night, he stood for a long time at the top of the stairs, and he went into the room where his very new baby daughter was sleeping. And he picked her up in his arms and very slowly rocked her back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while he rocked her, he sang, "I'll love you forever, I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be." From Psalm 127:3, sons are a heritage from the Lord, children a reward from him.
Good stuff. And if you'd like to share with us a story for Glenn's Story Corner, you can email it to us, morningair@relevantradio.com. And Glenn, that is a favorite story of ours. That's a bedtime story I've read to Julie more than once. It's a beautiful book by Robert Munch, I believe.
Yes, it is. I tell you, even as a big, tough radio announcer, it's kind of hard to get through that sometimes.
Yeah.
But awesome story. And as I was telling you off the air yesterday, actually, that book was just part of a piece that helped us make a big move back to our hometown from about 250 miles away. It happened about 15, 16 years ago. And actually, we're thinking about moving back closer to home as my folks were aging, getting into their 70s. And we kind of wanted to get settled before the kids began school. And so various things happened. And some health problems. And, you know, thinking about it, came up to the Twin Cities area on vacation and a couple new stations on the air. I tuned in one of them, and lo and behold, I heard the last announcer break of a friend of mine I had worked with years before. And if I hadn't tuned into that station just at that right time, I would have missed him and not thought any more about it. But called him up and come on over for a tour. And, you know, we'd been thinking about moving back to town, had been in a Bible study, studying when Jesus called the disciples, and it's like, what are you being called to do? And kind of felt being called back to the hometown and maybe eventually getting into Christian radio. And well, I ended up getting a job offer from that station. And while going back home to think about it, my dad had a heart procedure that very day when we were thinking about it and got the call in the middle of our conversation about whether to do it or not. And about that same time, we had found that book, and my mother was just, you know, crazy for me as a kid, and found out later, you know, in life that, you know, the circumstances around my adoption, that they'd had a child just 2 years before that had passed away after 3 days, and my mother's father had died the year before that, and her mother just a couple of years before that. So by the time I came along, it was quite the big deal, and you know, that story reminded me a lot of her, you know, crazy love. One of the factors involved in some of the neat God incidences that happened around the time of making that decision to move back back home. And then, you know, the twists and turns of the story, quickly, the station got sold even before our house in Iowa was sold, and we'd gotten totally moved up with the wife and kids. But we felt called, made that move, and as the station went away, I was able to get my first job then in Christian radio after that.
Oh, wow.
And so,
beautiful.
Anyway, but that story is part of it, yeah.
Thanks for sharing that. More to come on Morning Air.
People discover that media often ends up being a great source of spiritual and religious renewal.
This is Relevant Radio.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
In Albuquerque, New Mexico, two young men started a fire at a local abortion mill. One of the men, Sergio Baca, was trying to save the life of his unborn child. His ex-girlfriend was scheduled to have an abortion there the following day. He was desperately hoping the fire would stop her. What these men did was absolutely wrong. They got caught and sentenced to jail and have to make financial restitution. I counsel fathers of aborted babies and understand Sergio's misguided actions. God instills in men the desire to protect their offspring. It's a very strong instinct. Sergio's kicked in when it became likely his baby would die in an abortion chamber. The Supreme Court has ruled fathers have zero say over an abortion decision. This is barbaric and must change.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.
I didn't take my faith seriously, which probably means I never really got it to begin with. No, I didn't want to give up sin. I mean, the reason we sin is because sin is fun. But it's self-love sin. But it's amazing with God's grace how easy trying to not sin it really is.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church for whatever reason, we invite you to take another look. Visit CatholicsComeHome.org today.
There will be people who represent Christ in the sense that they make Christ present in a unique way. And that's why we call a priest Father.
Go Ask Your Father, weekdays at noon Central, 1 Eastern on Relevant Radio.
It's about 3 minutes in front of the hour. Sean Harriet on Morning Air, and really appreciated the story that Glenn shared with us. It's I'll Love You Forever, a book by Robert Munch. And I was just thinking during the break, it was kind of interesting to hear that, and right next to it, Father Tad Pohlchik's discussion of what to do with these leftover embryos from IVF procedures. As he mentioned, there are about 400,000 of them now, in this sort of state of suspended animation, limbo, whatever you want to call it, who they're stuck. And also, as Father Pohlchik was talking about, that he and others have been concerned for a long time that there was really no ethical way out of it. Embryo adoption is a movement that got kind of popular a few years ago as people were really just trying to figure out a way to address this issue. And certainly the children that were born that way are gifts from God, just as the children that were born through in vitro fertilization, or children, for that matter, who would be cloned. Hopefully that will never happen. The individual is always of infinite worth and value to God. The problem is how that individual comes to be and what it says about us really as a society. When it becomes more important that the child has some of your genetic material, when that becomes the overriding concern in terms of being a parent, there really is a problem there. And I think it's pretty clear we have a growing problem that is just not going to go away anytime soon. Hey, coming up, we've got news from the Vatican and around the world. I'm Sean Harriet. Thanks for joining me for this hour of Morning Air.
Thanks for listening to this hour of Morning Air on listener-supported Relevant Radio. For information on guests and topics, go to relevantradio.com and enter keyword Morning Air. That's relevantradio.com, keyword Morning Air.